partnership that would result in the revolutionary populist chunk of crypto code known by the three letters PGP began with a cold sales call. In 1983, Charlie Merritt, an Arkansas programmer and entrepreneur, was desperately searching for any computer maker who might be interested in reselling what seemed at the time like an obscure invention, his implementation of MIT's public key crypto system that could run on a desktop computer. When he dialed up Metamorphic Systems, a tiny Boulder, Colorado startup specializing in porting Apple software to Intel chips, the man on the other end of the line responded with so much excitement that Merritt thought he might have been planted by a friend as a prank. As he later told an encryption historian, his first impression of Metamorphic's founder, one Phil Zimmerman, was the most gee-whiz, whoopee, enthusiastic character I had run into. Since his college days, Zimmerman had gotten married, moved from Florida to Colorado to escape his native land's mosquitoes, and founded a less-than-stellar business porting Apple programs to run on Intel chips. But he had never lost his obsession with cryptography. Since reading Gardner's article, he had begun to imagine crypto as an increasingly necessary tool for grassroots organizing and international freedom fighting. Like many of his fellow hackers, Zimmerman shared David Chom's pessimistic vision that the rise of digital technologies threatened to render personal privacy extinct. The new medium of email was essentially a digital letter without an envelope, readable by any snoop who laid eyes on it. Governments would be able to spy on their citizens like never before. But strong, universally available encryption could flip that trend to the opposite extreme. Zimmerman envisioned Chinese democracy protesters, South American rebel groups, and radical American anti-nuclear activists emailing one another with impunity, free from the watchful eye of snooping Big Brother. In the early 80s, the FBI had raided the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, sweeping up as much private information as the agents could grab or copy. Imagine, as Zimmerman did, if instead of walking out with armfuls of useful intelligence on those activists, the Bureau had found only encrypted files, uncrackable by any known computer in the world. To a rebellious mongrel disciple of Herbert Zim and Daniel Ellsberg, it was an exhilarating thought. But as elegantly simple as the MIT researchers' public key encryption scheme seemed, Zimmerman still couldn't manage to implement it on his home computer. The PC's processor, a Z80, simply wasn't powerful enough. At one point, Zimmerman even called Ron Rivest, one of the three professors who had invented MIT's public key system, to ask his advice, only to find that MIT was running the program on a mainframe using Lisp, an artificial intelligence language beyond Zimmerman's means. Merritt, on the other hand, could perform the sorcery of public key encryption on a mundane microcomputer, the equivalent of assembling a three-mast model ship inside a perfume bottle. After their first conversation, Zimmerman began to call Merritt weekly to interrogate him for more details of how to pull off the miniaturized functions of the MIT cryptographer system. While Merritt had a long head start over Zimmerman, Zimmerman could program in C, a language that worked on everything from IBM computers to Ataris. Eventually, Merritt gave up on explaining mathematical operations over the phone and flew to Boulder, and the two men spent a week at his whiteboard hashing out crypto programming. Merritt quickly gave up on making any substantial money from his partnership with Zimmerman, but he appreciated Zimmerman's anti-authoritarian bent. For the last several years, Merritt had been repeatedly dogged and threatened by the National Security Agency. The secretive organization would pay visits to his office, pairs of serious-faced spooks in suits, and politely warn Merritt about a certain legal issue that might affect his company: the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR. To the U.S. government's mind, cryptography was the realm of soldiers and spies, not common entrepreneurs like Merritt. Ever since the British encryption genius Alan Turing had broken the Nazis' Enigma encryption engine at Bletchley Park, it had been clear to the military that code-breaking and code-making were as important for winning wars as missile guidance systems, bomber blueprints, and nuclear warheads. And when it came to deciding who could legally access which tools, ITAR painted military hardware and software with the same broad brush. Exporting encryption was just as illegal as hawking uranium to the Libyans. That meant Merritt could only sell his pint-sized crypto system in the United States and Canada. And because his customers were mostly concerned about maintaining their privacy from regimes less friendly than the U.S. government, ITAR was choking his business. Zimmerman, on the other hand, wasn't concerned about export controls. After all, he only planned to give away any tools he created as grassroots political tools, not sell them. Why would customs agents bother him over his insignificant do-gooder hobby? In 1987, Zimmerman had pulled together much of his newfound crypto programming know-how into an article published in the well-regarded technology journal IEEE Computer. The prestige the paper won for Zimmerman allowed him to start calling other cryptographers around the world for advice and coding contributions without coming off as just another paranoid cipher nut. Thanks in part to those volunteers, Zimmerman's encryption mini-engine was making steady progress. He decided to give it a name, one as folksy and humble as Zimmerman himself. Pretty Good Privacy. The reference was to Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, a fictional store on the Garrison Keillor National Public Radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. Soon, Zimmerman also had a new deadline, supplied by the U.S. government. The Omnibus Crime Bill of 1991, known as S-266, contained an inconspicuous paragraph inserted by none other than Delaware Senator Joe Biden. It is the sense of Congress that providers of electronic communications services and manufacturers of electronic communications service equipment shall ensure that communications systems permit the government to obtain the plain text contents of voice, data, and other communications when appropriately authorized by law. Congress, like the NSA, could see that the U.S. government was losing its monopoly on uncrackable encryption. It needed a trump card against the Phil Zimmermans and Tim Mays of the world, who might try to subvert the government's authority through the power of perfectly private information. That trump card, Biden's addition to the bill made clear, would be the ability to decrypt any communication traveling across a telecom firm's network. The U.S. government, after all, saw encryption very much as Tim May saw it, a mathematically rigorous method of castrating law enforcement and intelligence agencies. In a Senate hearing in 1997, FBI Director Louis Freeh would put it this way: uncrackable encryption will allow drug lords, spies, terrorists, and even violent gangs to communicate about their crimes and their conspiracies with impunity. We will lose one of the few remaining vulnerabilities of the worst criminals and terrorists upon which law enforcement depends to successfully investigate and often prevent the worst crimes. With encryption running rampant, who knows what evil would lurk within the scrambled messages racing across the internet? Biden's S-22 was designed as a preemptive strike in the struggle for control of secrecy. The first shot fired in the crypto wars that would shake the worlds of privacy and national security for the next decade and beyond. Zimmerman read about the surreptitious addition to Congress's crime bill on a Usenet bulletin board, and alarms went off in the anti-authoritarian lobes of his brain. A former consultant to the NSA added a bit of prophetic commentary to the Usenet discussion. "I suggest you begin to stock up on crypto gear while you still can get it." Zimmerman felt he had to finish PGP before that bill became law, so he dropped everything and worked day and night to develop his crypto embryo and deliver it into the world. He neglected his day job and consulting gigs so thoroughly that he missed 5 mortgage payments. "I really honed my negotiation skills with banks," Zimmerman says. Within hours of posting it to Usenet, PGP began spreading like a prairie fire, fueled in part by fears of a government crypto crackdown on the way. It was passed among encryption enthusiasts around the world with a message that every copy distributed was another point scored against the government's efforts to smother the populist privacy movement. One encryption activist became PGP's paranoid Paul Revere, riding around California's Bay Area in his car with a laptop and an acoustic coupler and using payphones to log on and upload copies of the program to message boards without revealing the program's source. Within hours of its creation, PGP had jumped over U.S. borders and multiplied itself around the globe, directly violating ITAR's ban on cryptographic exports. PGP fulfilled Zimmerman's dream as a political weapon almost immediately. Activists in Myanmar used the encryption program to hide communications from a brutal military junta that would kill its citizens for even owning a fax machine. A Bosnian user sent Zimmerman a message to say that during the siege of Sarajevo, his father had used PGP to encrypt emails to his family during the hour or two of occasional electricity in the war-torn city. Finally, he received a PGP-encrypted message that would make all of Zimmerman's missed mortgage payments worthwhile. It came from a user in Latvia, where fear still ran high that the newly independent nations and former satellite states of the crumbled USSR would be swept under a new repressive regime. "Phil, I wish you to know, let it never be, but if dictatorship takes over Russia, your PGP is widespread from Baltic to Far East now and will help democratic people if necessary. Thanks." Shortly after the release of his second version of PGP in 1993, Zimmerman received a call from a U.S. customs agent in San Jose. She asked him for more information on his humble invention, and Zimmerman cheerfully answered her questions, thinking that she had perhaps encountered PGP on a computer the agency was investigating and was merely curious about it. But when the agent told Zimmerman she planned to fly all the way to Boulder to pay him a visit, Zimmerman began to get nervous. Zimmerman was aware of Charlie Merritt's export warnings, and he had always known that distributing cryptography across foreign borders was illegal. He had simply never thought the government would take notice of his modest hobby. A few months later, a formal notice arrived in the mail. Zimmerman was the subject of a grand jury investigation. His potential crime? Sharing his beloved PGP with the world. The news put Zimmerman into a state of shock. Spending an afternoon or even a night in a Nevada jail swapping activist war stories with his fellow pacifists was one thing. The thought of years in a federal prison for simply writing software and putting it on the internet was more than a pudgy computer programmer could handle. He called a criminal lawyer, Phil Dubois, a former public defender known in Boulder for being scrappy and cheap. Zimmerman was still catching up with his mortgage payments and could hardly afford a crack defense team. On his first visit to Dubois' office, he spotted some files in a box on the floor marked Michael Bell Discovery Documents. Bell was a notorious Colorado murderer who had killed four people and then hidden in the mountains before being tracked down by the largest manhunt in Boulder history. This, Zimmerman thought, was how the government saw him. He had become America's first crypto criminal. Tim May had finally figured out what he wanted to do with his post-Intel life. He would write a science fiction novel that expressed the full power of David Chaum's inventions, how they could subvert institutions and empower individuals. It would be a techno-libertarian call to arms, Ayn Rand on public key encrypted steroids. May began wading into academic cryptography papers and even came up with a title for his science fiction brainchild, Degrees of Freedom, a play on the thermodynamic physics term that also referred to the new political flexibilities that would be opened on the anonymous digital frontier. In 1988, May took his first crack at putting his ideas on paper, though in nonfiction form, the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto. It was a short document, but its Marxist parodying language carried all the weight of a history-shaping treatise. A specter is haunting the modern world, the specter of crypto anarchy. Computer technology is on the verge of providing the ability for individuals and groups to communicate and interact with each other in a totally anonymous manner. Two persons may exchange messages, conduct business, and negotiate electronic contracts without ever knowing the true name or legal identity of the other. Interactions over networks will be untraceable via extensive rerouting of encrypted packets and tamper-proof boxes, which implement cryptographic protocols with nearly perfect assurance against any tampering. The state will, of course, try to slow or halt the spread of this technology, citing national security concerns, use of the technology by drug dealers and tax evaders, and fears of societal disintegration. Many of these concerns will be valid. Crypto anarchy will allow national secrets to be traded freely and will allow illicit and stolen materials to be traded. An anonymous computerized market will even make possible abhorrent markets for assassinations and extortion. Various criminal and foreign elements will be active users of CryptoNet. But this will not halt the spread of crypto anarchy. Just as the technology of printing altered and reduced the power of medieval guilds and the social power structure, so too will cryptologic methods fundamentally alter the nature of corporations and of government interference in economic transactions. Combined with emerging information markets, crypto anarchy will create a liquid market for any and all material which can be put into words and pictures. And just as a seemingly minor invention like barbed wire made possible the fencing off of vast ranches and farms, thus altering forever the concepts of land and property rights in the frontier West, so too will the seemingly minor discovery out of an arcane branch of mathematics come to be the wire clippers which dismantle the barbed wire around intellectual property. Arise! You have nothing to lose but your barbed wire fences. May photocopied a few hundred copies and drove down to the crypto conference in Santa Barbara, convened by none other than his newfound guru, David Chaum. He passed out the flyers at the conference, though the academics largely ignored him. They weren't thinking about the political implications yet, he says. But Thomas Paine-style pamphleteering aside, May was struggling as a writer. He couldn't translate his overactive imagination into characters and stories that captured his technical ideas. Meanwhile, he began to get the panicky sense that the concepts he had thought were prescient and futuristic were appearing in the real world faster than he could put them into fiction. He read press reports about an airline bugging its business class seats to acquire corporate intel, the NSA wiretapping Wall Street firms, and New York mafiosi busted after cops figured out the gangsters were using their wives' AOL accounts as dead drops for incriminating communications. It was all happening much too fast. After nearly three full years of writer's block, May came to a realization. Instead of telling the story of how encryption and anonymity were changing society, he would simply be the protagonist. "I didn't want to work on this stupid novel," he says. "I wanted to actually build this elaborate world that I was imagining." Around that time, a mathematician and programmer friend named Eric Hughes had come to Berkeley to look for a place to live in the Bay Area while he applied to graduate school. A wayward Mormon who grew up near Washington, D.C. and in Salt Lake City, Hughes shared May's frontier style of cowboy hats and leather, though instead of a beard, he wore a blazing red goatee. He also shared May's libertarian ideals and the sense that cryptography would help to keep the government's tendrils safely hogtied. The pair had met at a party thrown by their libertarian hacker friend, John Gilmore, a ponytailed and balding software developer whose sad eyes hid a fiercely independent streak. As the fifth employee of Sun Microsystems, Gilmore had struck it rich in software, just as May had in hardware, and retired from the world of Silicon Valley to pursue his digital whims and libertarian ideals. Since Gilmore's party, Hughes had gone off to work as a coder for none other than the grandmaster of anonymity, David Chaum, at the anonymous transaction startup he had created in Amsterdam. The gig hadn't worked out. "I'll never work for him in any context ever again," Hughes says flatly when I ask about his time with Chaum in the Netherlands. "At this point, I should say that if you can't say anything nice about someone, you shouldn't say anything at all." Hughes may not have jibed with Chaum's personality, but he was almost as obsessed with Chom's ideas as May was. So when May suggested Hughes use his home as a base for a few days while looking for a place to live, the pair hit it off like Marx and Engels. Hughes neglected his real estate search to wander with May through Santa Cruz's redwood forests and beaches, while the older ex-scientist unloaded several years' worth of bottled-up ideas. We spent 3 intense days talking about math, protocols, domain-specific languages, secure anonymous systems, says May. Man, it was fun. Just a week after Zimmerman released PGP 2.0, Hughes and May invited 40 of their favorite coders and cryptographers to Hughes's newly purchased home in Oakland. About 20 of them showed up, and the group, mostly wearing its de facto uniform of beards and ponytails, crowded into the furniture-free living room and sat cross-legged on his floor. Tim May, a larger man and a louder personality than Hughes, presided. He distributed a 57-page handout of background materials and began by reading his crypto-anarchist manifesto to great approval. Then Hughes and May moved on to a game they'd invented, more or less on the spot, called Crypto Anarchy. It was based, like many of May's fantasies, on an idea from David Chom. This one was called a mix network. The concept of a mix was a simple one from years before Chom's seminal Big Brother paper with its crypto card computers and networks of dining cryptographers. It would also become by far the most influential of Chom's ideas, and one that would reshape anonymity technologies for decades to come. Users of a mix network give the slip to anyone who might be tracking them the same way they would in the real world, by getting lost in the crowd. If someone is being tailed, she might go into a movie theater, find a seat in the dark, and then reemerge in a crowd of people. But a mix network gives the followed a much larger head start over the follower. To extend the same analogy, it ushers a crowd of people into a theater, all of whom want to avoid being followed, gives them a chance to remove their hats, wigs, sunglasses, and clothes, and put on new ones, and then releases them again. Then the crowd disperses to mix with other crowds of disguised people who enter other theaters with other crowds, change their disguises, and repeat the process until no stalker has any hope of keeping up with his target. Chom came up with mixes 2 years after Martin Gardner's article on public key encryption, and it cleverly applied the MIT researcher's idea of a cipher that only one intended recipient could unscramble. But Chom took the encryption idea another step. He imagined encrypting the message multiple times in layers. The first layer of encryption would use the public key of the intended recipient as usual. But then the encrypted message would be encrypted again, only this time using the public key of an intermediary. That middleman's job would simply be to decrypt the outer layer of encryption with his or her public key. Inside would be a forwarding address and the rest of the message, still encrypted with that first layer of scrambling. If that middleman, what would come to be known as a remailer, collected enough messages before decrypting them and forwarding them out in a large batch, there would be little way for anyone eavesdropping on the network to know the origin of any of those messages. Not even the recipient would necessarily know. If the message contained no information about the sender, it would show up at its destination, encrypted specifically for that recipient, but with no evidence of who had sent it. Or it could contain an encrypted return address, but suggest that the recipient reply through another remailer, so that no snoop would be able to know that the two were communicating. Chom had taken encryption, which masks the content of a message, and applied it to create anonymity, which protects something else altogether, the identity of the people communicating. His mix idea didn't end there. If a message could be wrapped in 2 layers of encryption and routed through a remailer, why not encrypt it 3 times and send it through 2 relays? Or encrypt it 6 times and bounce it through 5 remailers, each of which has the key to remove just 1 layer of encryption before forwarding it? With multiple ricochets, not even the remailers themselves need to be trusted. Each one would know only the next recipient, not the entire chain from sender to recipient. And even if a large number of those remailers betrayed the users and collaborated to try and link the ends of the chain, just one trustworthy link, one remailer who refused to spill the beans, would ensure that the identities of the two ends of the chain couldn't be matched up. In their game of crypto anarchy in Hughes' living room, May and Hughes split their hacker friends into two teams, one of ambassadors, corporations, and rebels trying to communicate anonymously and securely, and the other acting as spies trying to eavesdrop on those communications. The communicators wrote messages on slips of paper and hid them in envelopes to represent PGP, putting those envelopes inside of other envelopes and addressing them to remailer friends, including some members of the spy team posing as trusted remailers, to try and route secret anonymous messages to each other. In their simulated game of spying cats and crypto rebel mice, Chom's ideas came through clearly. With enough layers of encryption and just a few trustworthy friends, the mice could actually win the game. The meeting's drafted hackers were soon infected with all the same excited sense of encryption's potential as May and Hughes themselves. They talked late into the night, slept on Hughes' floor, and dreamed of crypto anarchy. The next morning, May and Hughes went out to buy bagels and brainstorm about the potential of the group that had begun to coalesce around their meeting. Why limit the club to the physical world, for instance, when the real mass of potential cryptography fanatics was online? As May had years earlier realized, cyber utopias would have to be created on the internet, not in someone's living room. They later asked John Gilmore if he would host an email list on the server of his personal site, Toad.com, and he eagerly agreed. But it was Jude Milhon, Hughes' girlfriend several decades his senior, who provided the group's name. At the time, science fiction authors like William Gibson and Neal Stephenson had adopted the cyberpunk genre, stories of bohemian hackers fighting steely megacorporations in virtual worlds. But Milhon, a writer for the early technoculture magazine Mondo 2000, told Hughes that the group he and May were creating wasn't composed of mere cyberpunks, but a new species of hacker, cypherpunks. So Gilmore's email forum was christened the Cypherpunk Mailing List. As it blossomed to nearly 1,000 subscribers over the mid-1990s, its physical meetings would expand too. Within a year, the group had moved out of Hughes' house and into a spare conference room at John Gilmore's software company Cygnus in Mountain View, in a building that bordered an herb farm and was permeated with the scent of fresh basil. The cypherpunks would assemble there monthly, eat burritos, and then sit through talks from invited academics and hobbyist crypto rebels on their latest schemes, coded contraptions, and diatribes about secrecy politics. The group kept its strong libertarian strain. One adjunct group called the Cypherpunk Shooting Club even organized trips to rifle ranges to teach each other to shoot .22s and semi-automatic weapons. The final resort, should the government ever come after their electronic and physical freedoms. Tim May, an avid gun enthusiast himself, didn't attend. "I don't give free lessons, especially not to clueless software people," he says. Shortly after the group's first meeting, John Gilmore and another cypherpunk named Hugh Daniel had bet Hughes that he couldn't write an anonymous remailer system for stripping the identifying traces off email messages within a single month. The next weekend, Hughes dropped all his other projects and cranked out a script in the software language Perl in just 2 days. It became the first official cypherpunk remailer and would be copied and improved upon by a dozen others in universities and basements around the world to form a growing, living implementation of Chom's Mix Network. Around the same time, Hughes answered May's crypto anarchist manifesto with an updated Cypherpunks manifesto, laying out the group's common mission and the tenets of its newborn subculture. It included a sentence that would become a philosophical maxim for the group: "Cypherpunks write code." The slogan represented action instead of rhetoric. Writing tools that would shape the world of technology so that when the government belatedly arrived to regulate it, the feds would find an untamable landscape populated by crypto-wielding civilians. "We know that someone has to write software to defend privacy, and since we can't get privacy unless we all do, we're going to write it. We don't much care if you don't approve of the software we write. We know that software can't be destroyed, and that a widely dispersed system can't be shut down. Even laws against cryptography reach only so far as a nation's border and the arm of its violence. That anti-regulation note was a prescient message. Within a month, the U.S. government would test the cypherpunks' resolve. As Zimmerman polishes off his noodles, I pull a tome off the shelf in his dining room, the one that changed the course of his life 15 years earlier. PGP, Source Code and Internals. As the title suggests, it's literally a printed copy of PGP's code, hardly legible to humans, not to mention the non-geek members of a jury deciding Zimmerman's fate. But as Zimmerman explains, it wasn't any argument or fact written in that volume, but rather the book's mere existence. The fact that PGP's source code was represented in ink on slices of pulped tree between two sheets of cardboard, that made it a crucial weapon in the crypto wars. In 1993, 2 years before that book was printed and shortly after Zimmerman had been formally notified about a grand jury assembled to decide whether he would be prosecuted, he had been summoned to Washington to testify in a congressional hearing on the future of cryptography. Word of his case spread quickly through the legal community, and by the time he arrived in Washington, lawyers from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union were ready to represent him in his upcoming trial. All of them, to his dismay, believed he had absolutely no chance of winning. In a meeting after his congressional testimony, his pro bono lawyers sat around a conference table and told Zimmerman that there was little doubt that he had done exactly what the law prohibited: created a program that included military-grade encryption and distributed it across U.S. borders. To have 10 lawyers all tell me almost unanimously that it was hopeless, it was a ton of bricks. It was the worst day, he says. Only one lawyer seemed optimistic. Phil Dubois, the cut-rate criminal lawyer that Zimmerman had hired in Boulder. Dubois clashed with Zimmerman's other counsel on the strategic question of taking his case to the press. As a peace activist, Zimmerman instinctively felt he should publicize his pending indictment. And against the advice of all of his other lawyers, Dubois agreed. After all, Zimmerman wasn't an accused drug dealer or murderer like some of Dubois' other clients. He was a soft-spoken, suit-wearing nerd whose crime was only to have written a privacy-preserving piece of software. Phil was just delighted to have a client who didn't have a spider web tattooed on his face, Zimmerman says. Their media strategy mattered, because Zimmerman's case was about to become especially newsworthy. Shortly after the grand jury was assigned to investigate him, the prophecy of Joe Biden's S-266 finally came true. The newly elected Clinton administration unveiled a new invention called the Clipper Chip and brought to life every cypherpunk's nightmare. The chip, designed by the NSA, was meant to solve the government's crypto dilemma. It aimed to offer strong cryptography to the public without giving up the government's ability to decrypt any message it wished to. The Clipper Chip would be made available to private industry so that eventually every computer or phone that offered encryption would use its new classified scheme known as Skipjack. But in return for that NSA-created scrambling technology, there was a catch. The U.S. government would keep a copy of a backdoor key to every chip in the database, ready to step in and unlock any message. To May and Hughes' crowd, the chip was stark confirmation. The government feared cryptography because of its subversive power and was determined to cripple it. Who was the NSA kidding? Encryption becomes useless the moment anyone other than you has a copy of your private key. And when that someone is none other than Big Brother, the entire idea is a sick, deceitful parody. When the plan became public in a front-page New York Times story, the cypherpunks held an emergency meeting on a Saturday that packed Cygnus's conference space. They brainstormed about possible schemes to undermine the dreaded chip, from boycotts of AT&T which it signed on to put the clipper in an encrypted phone it had begun selling, to injecting negative stories into the press. Tim May drew the Intel Inside logo, created by his former employer, on the whiteboard at Cygnus, replacing the words with Big Brother Inside. The cypherpunks later printed that logo on stickers and would sneak into electronics stores to plant it on any machine infected by the hated Clipper spy bug. A cease and desist letter from Intel threatening a suit for trademark infringement eventually kiboshed that guerrilla sticker campaign. Privacy groups from the Electronic Privacy Information Center to the Electronic Frontier Foundation railed against the idea in the press, and even tech titans like Bill Gates spoke out against what they saw as the government putting its clumsy hands into Silicon Valley, the greatest economic engine of the 1990s. But it was Phil Zimmerman who embodied Hugh's maxim. Cypherpunks write code. And there was no better response to the threat of the Clipper chip than ubiquitous PGP. The man who had populated the internet with free, uncrackable crypto had remained at a remove from the cypherpunks. He viewed their gun-toting, ponytailed culture as counterproductive compared to his suit-and-tie mainstream approach. I saw them as angry young men in leather jackets, without children and with too much testosterone, he says. Several times Zimmerman ran into May during trips to the Bay Area and pleaded with him to tone down his anti-government rhetoric. After all, PGP's inventor was the one facing incarceration for the crypto cause, not May. And he felt that May's movement painted him as another techno-insurgent hell-bent on destroying the government, exactly the image he needed to avoid. May being May, he firmly refused to tone down a word of his anarchist philosophy. Meanwhile, Zimmerman had been drafted by the media as the face of the crypto wars, the man who had put his freedom on the line to fight for the right to privacy. And against the advice of all his lawyers except Phil Dubois, he assumed that role with Ellsberg-like gusto, taking dozens of interviews a week from newspapers and magazines. The resulting articles almost universally came out against crypto export laws and the Clipper chip. Every last article was sympathetic to me, says Zimmerman. Not 99%, 100.0%. Though he wasn't one of them, the cypherpunks held Zimmerman up as a folk hero. And it was a cypherpunk, the Qualcomm researcher Phil Karn, who followed Hugh's maxim that code, not mere words, would prove the best way to undermine the government's regulations and keep Zimmerman out of prison. The cypherpunks, with their eagle eye for vulnerabilities in security software, also had a knack for finding legal loopholes. After one astute subscriber to the mailing list found a clause that allowed munitions like Stinger missiles to be exported if they were in fact being fired at an enemy country, there was some discussion of strapping a copy of PGP to a missile and shooting it at Mexico, just to prove a point. But Karn found a better trick to undermine those export laws, with all the subtleties of a cryptanalytic attack. The State Department allowed Americans to apply for permission to export goods if they weren't sure about whether they qualified as munitions or other contraband. So Karn bought a copy of Bruce Schneier's book, Applied Cryptography, and sent it to the State Department to ask for export permission. In one of its appendices, the textbook contained the source code for the Digital Encryption Standard, DES, the NSA's declassified encryption scheme for military and civilian uses. Some unwitting official at the State Department took a look at Schneier's book and quickly rubber-stamped the request. Then came the second stage of Karn's multi-pronged maneuver. He sent the same DES code to the State Department with the same exact request, but this time it was stored on a floppy disk. When they got that one, I can imagine the blood draining from their faces, Zimmerman says gleefully. The State Department had figured out Karn's game by this point and denied his floppy disk request. He appealed and was denied again, so Karn sued them in a federal court. While that lawsuit was underway, Zimmerman ran into an editor at MIT Press while attending a privacy conference. The editor wanted to publish the PGP user's manual that Zimmerman had included with PGP 1.0. Zimmerman was willing, but he asked for a favor. "I'd like you to also publish the source code to PGP," Zimmerman said. "All of it." The code added up to close to 800 pages, and MIT printed it in a font that was designed to be easily readable for scanning software, so that it could be converted from ink to bits with minimal effort. Zimmerman was playing with the distinction highlighted by Phil Karn's trick. Rendering the line between words, protected by the First Amendment, and ITAR banned code as blurry as possible. MIT Press played along and enacted the final piece of Phil Karn's pincer attack. The publishing house mailed its bound, legitimate-looking textbook filled with PGP's source code to the State Department's Export Approval Office. The department, caught in its own contradictions, never responded to MIT's request for export permission. So with only silence from the U.S. government, MIT Press went ahead and shipped the book to European bookstores along with all its other textbooks. PGP had been exported right under the government's nose. It's doubtful many Europeans ever scanned that book to implement its code. PGP was already being used across the world, after all. But now Zimmerman's legal team could wield that bound chunk of paper, the one, today long out of print, sitting on Zimmerman's shelf, as a logic bomb planted under the feet of Zimmerman's prosecutors that they would detonate as soon as he was indicted. In the end, the Justice Department dropped its investigation into PGP with no explanation. Zimmerman never found out whether it was his public support, Karn's export trick, or simply a lack of political will behind his prosecution that saved him. The government's crypto fearmongers were busy anyway, trying to rescue their failing clipper chip scheme. Public opinion had swung violently against the plan, with 80% of Americans opposing it in one CNN poll. Silicon Valley didn't want to touch it. And to add to the Clinton administration's perfect storm, an encryption researcher at Bell Labs named Matt Blaze had found a vulnerability in the scheme that made it trivial to crack. By 1996, Clipper was sunk. Zimmerman and the cypherpunks had taken on the government and won the first great battle of the crypto wars. Cryptography, in all its applications from grassroots activism to child pornography to terrorism to untraceable whistleblowing, belonged to the people. As I wrap up my interview with Zimmerman and he puts his PGP source code book back on the shelf, I ask, almost out of a sense of obligation more than hope, whether he has any idea of how I can get in touch with Tim May, or whether he's truly become the well-armed and misanthropic mountain hermit he's described to be. "Let me see," Zimmerman says. He picks up his iPhone, and in a few seconds, he and May are discussing the nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant in Japan, and the potential of thorium reactors to replace uranium reactors in future generations. Then Zimmerman passes the phone to me. May apologizes for not getting back to me earlier, and as we talk, he checks his email's draft folder to find that he somehow forgot to push send on his response to my message to him. In fact, he's less than a mile away at a bookstore in downtown Santa Cruz. "Everyone always calls me the elusive Tim May," he says into the phone, sounding flabbergasted. "I'll talk to any reporter who calls me." When I find May in the bookshop Santa Cruz, he's just finishing flipping disinterestedly through a copy of a book by former WikiLeaks staffer Daniel Domscheit-Berg, a tell-all memoir of his time at the Secret Spilling Group. May's beard has expanded in the years since the 1990s, and his arched eyebrows have spiked upward like coarse dark feathers. He's wearing a leather-brimmed hat and a pink shirt with white studs, and generally looks much like the mad scientist frontiersman recluse that Dietz Zeit described. But as we walk down the street to a cafe, he's practically rupturing with ideas he's ready to share. He quizzes me excitedly about a lattice-based scheme for fully homomorphic cryptography that I barely understand, and then tells me about his own ideas for lattice-based data structures which I don't understand at all. But when we sit down, he settles into the matter at hand. The idea that was, to many, the most influential and controversial thought he produced in his role as what John Gilmore calls the Thomas Jefferson of the cypherpunks. That idea was BlackNet. BlackNet was a thought experiment, the fruit of Chom's anonymity ideas applied to Phil Salen's online data market, and it aimed to prove that combination's full potential in a wholly imaginary setting. It was also the primordial, evolutionary ancestor to WikiLeaks. In 1993, May had learned about the Democracy Wall, a brick wall in the Shidan neighborhood of Beijing where late 1970s democracy dissidents had left poetry and anti-government messages for each other and for the public. The government eventually cracked down on that wall-based messaging system, moving it to a park where visitors had to show identification papers to enter. May fantasized about a true democracy wall online, one without restrictions where public key cryptography would defeat the government's identification efforts and let anyone post a message that only the recipient could retrieve. When you licked that envelope and sent it to this site, no one in the whole fucking world would know who had sent it or who retrieved it, May says, his voice perceptibly shaking with excitement. In the summer of that year, May wove together his untraceable message board ideas with Phil Salen's dream of an online information market. And he sent the following unattributed statement to the cypherpunk mailing list, routing it through anonymous remailers to shroud it in mystery. Your name has come to our attention. We have reason to believe you may be interested in the products and services our new organization, BlackNet, has to offer. BlackNet is in the business of buying, selling, trading, and otherwise dealing with information in all its many forms. We buy and sell information using public key crypto systems with essentially perfect security for our customers. Unless you tell us who you are, please don't, or inadvertently reveal information which provides clues, we have no way of identifying you, nor you us. Our location in physical space is unimportant. Our location in cyberspace is all that matters. We can be contacted, preferably through a chain of anonymous remailers, by encrypting a message to our public key contained below and depositing this message in one of the several locations in cyberspace we monitor. The message went on to list types of information in which BlackNet was particularly interested, including buyout or merger rumors, trade secrets, and confidential product designs ranging from children's toys to cruise missiles, and it offered to pay for them with crypto credits, an untraceable digital currency. BlackNet spread through the cypherpunks and onto other mailing lists and Usenet groups like a nuclear chain reaction. May says he later learned that it reached several labs working on confidential projects, and Oak Ridge National Laboratories even issued a warning to staff to report any contact with a shadowy organization. Just a couple of weeks after his first anonymous message, he sent out another email, this time taking credit for the scheme and declaring the game over. Of course, crypto credits never existed. Neither did the underground cabal behind the purported digital black market. But with technologies that existed even then, they could have. BlackNet, May wrote, was a demonstration of classified classifieds, so to speak. No more secrets. At least, no more secrets that you don't keep yourself. A subtle point. Crypto anarchy doesn't mean a no-secrets society. It means a society in which individuals must protect their own secrets and not count on governments or corporations to do it for them. It also means public secrets, like troop movements and stealth production plans or the tricks of implanting wafers, will not remain secret for long. To the governments of the world, facing these and other threats to their continued ways of doing business, the existence of strong encryption in the hands of the population is indeed a mortal threat. In any case, it's too late. The genie's nearly completely out of the bottle. National borders are just speed bumps on the information highway. Even in the short time before May called off his BlackNet experiment, it proved its purpose. Just before he sent his email taking credit for the ruse, a message encrypted with BlackNet's PGP key appeared on one of the Usenet groups that May had said BlackNet would monitor. It promised to offer evidence that the CIA was spying on ambassadors in Washington from a Central African country and to expose internal corruption in the country's government. As May tells it, he decrypted the message with BlackNet's private key. He read it, then he put it in an archive folder and never responded. Why? May says that he had shown that BlackNet could serve its intended purpose. But he argues, a little defensively, that trying to set up a WikiLeaks-like system to distribute or publish black market information required operational security he couldn't handle. Even if he had kept BlackNet's source secret, he was clearly the cypherpunk's prime suspect for enacting such a scheme. And he points out that the message may have also been a honey trap designed to ensnare him and put him in prison. But more frankly, May says, he simply didn't care. He was and remains a hardcore libertarian looking out for his own Randian self-interest, not a whistleblower advocate trying to expose corruption. I'm not concerned about things like that. Let the Africans kill each other, he says flatly. I don't have those kinds of political interests. When I later ask Jacob Applebaum, one of the only Americans to associate openly with WikiLeaks, about his thoughts on BlackNet, he sees things more simply. Tim May is a fucking racist, he says. And it's really a shame, because if he weren't, he would have created WikiLeaks himself and made a real difference in the world. When I repeat Applebaum's comment to May, he chuckles. I call him as I see him, he says. If I see blacks driving themselves into the gutter, I call it as it is. May pauses for a moment. I had the opportunity to either light a candle or teach people how to make candles, he says. I had the ideas, but the idea of trying to be Julian Assange gives me the creeps. John Gilmore and I are looking out onto the shiny wet streets of San Francisco's Mission District as the entire cypherpunk mailing list archive, all 345 megabytes spanning nearly a decade of hacker rants, attacks, critiques, and announcements that once lived on his server, is siphoned onto my thumb drive. When the bits have finished flowing from his tiny laptop to my stick of solid-state memory, Gilmore opens up the first folder. Since the days of the cypherpunks, his long, wispy beard has shifted to the whitish gray of a caricatured martial arts master, and his manifold brow has extended to cover his eyes with hoods that wrinkle as he cracks open the cypherpunk's dusty archives. The first messages are introductions from Tim May, Eric Hughes, and John Gilmore, along with Eric Hughes' declaration of the first cypherpunk remailer, built on Gilmore's dare. And then comes another message containing only an article from the Sydney Morning Herald in August 1992. It seems to have been sent, strangely, by the list itself. In fact, Hughes explains bemusedly, the sender used a fast and dirty trick to protect his or her anonymity, one that didn't require any remailers or other fancy methods. The message's header was spoofed to resemble the cypherpunk lists, and then ricocheted off a random non-existent address so that it would bounce back with an error message to its fake return address. The news article details how corporations in Australia, including National Australia Bank and Citicorp, bought proprietary information about citizens from government agencies for millions of dollars, often using it to track down debtors. Gilmore looks over the text thoughtfully and turns to me. It seems some anonymous person has posted an article from an Australian newspaper about the government leaking information, he says with a smile. I wonder who that could have been.